This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak about the suppression of journalists, the death of over 126 journalists in Israel, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank.
Our guest is Kevin Gastola, editor of the Dissenter newsletter. He'll also talk with us about the arrest of U.S. journalist Jeremy Lofredo by the Israeli occupational forces.
We focus in on the need for people to acknowledge the consequences of nuclear war, as grim as that may be, but some groups are making headway to change that. We hear from one of the foremost authorities on the subject, Dr. Ira Helfand, co-founder of the nonprofit Back from the Brink campaign. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. Freedom of the press is one of the most important tools the public has to check government power and hold accountable those who would abuse that power. Since October 7th, 2023, the pressure on journalists who are trying to cover what's been happening in Gaza and the West Bank has become increasingly difficult and dangerous. According to the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists, the Israel-Gaza war has claimed the lives of more journalists over the course of a year than in any other conflict the organization has documented. They estimate 128 journalists already killed and 69 imprisoned, and those numbers have been rising. The foreign and Israeli journalists who are bold enough to enter Gaza and report on what's happening can only do so if they're accompanied by Israeli forces and under strict surveillance. And the Israeli military has no qualms about shutting down news outlets like Al Jazeera, even its bureau in Ramallah, in the West Bank, which is an area supposedly under Palestinian control. And just last week, Israeli occupational forces arrested a U.S. citizen, journalist Jeremy Lofredo, charging him with endangering national security for his reporting on Iranian strikes. Reporters Without Borders condemns what it calls Israel's climate of intimidation and has called on the Israeli authorities to stop obstructing the work of journalists covering the war. To talk through all of this, we're pleased to have with us Kevin Gastola. Kevin is a journalist and editor of the Dissenter newsletter, which regularly covers whistleblowing, press freedom, and government secrecy. He is the author of Guilty of Journalism, The Political Case Against Julian Assange, and known for his work reporting on the extradition proceedings against Assange and the court-martial against Chelsea Manning. Both were prosecuted and convicted under the Espionage Act. Kevin Gastola, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Kevin, can you start us off with a snapshot of press freedom in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza right now? Are we, the public, getting independent and critical news stories about what is happening? And if not, what are some of the major obstacles?
The answer to that is anybody who is within Israel right now, as I understand from an acclaimed and well-known columnist for Haaretz, Gideon Levy, I understand that for the most part, the Israeli media organizations have wholly disengaged over the last year plus since October 7th, that they are not that interested in what's going on with Gaza, and images of the destruction, devastation, the extensive amount of death, they just don't make it into Israeli homes, and that's by intention. It's a commercial choice, but it's also because the public, by and large, is on board with the Israeli government's objectives. And so in Israel, there isn't a lot of space for dissenting voices like Gideon. There's definitely not space for Arabs who are there. Palestinian Israelis are given very little space to speak out against this war. They're susceptible to being arrested for what we could describe as speech crimes. If we look over to the West Bank and Gaza, we've seen systematic attacks primarily, and also within Israel, we've seen attacks on the Al Jazeera news network. It has an Arabic network, and it also has a very well-respected English network, Al Jazeera English. And within Israel, there's a national security law that was passed earlier this year. A few months into the conflict, there was a push to criminalize explicitly Al Jazeera. They came up with a law that they could apply to make it seem like it wasn't just specific to Al Jazeera, but they've only gone after Al Jazeera and their offices. But it gives Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu the ability to say that the Al Jazeera network is a mouthpiece for Hamas and then wholesale shut down the offices and ban every 45 days it can be renewed, but to ban anybody with the network from being able to do journalism. And it's intended to shut down one of the only networks that is broadcasting images from within Gaza. And then if we look to Gaza, what we've seen is the deadliest conflict ever since press freedom organizations started tracking these journalist deaths. The numbers vary. I take the higher number, but it's about 177 journalists, and the lowest count is like 130 journalists at this point that have been killed in this conflict. You have systematic efforts to detain journalists, prevent them from being able to operate. There's an administrative detention law that's actually inherited from the days of British colonialism, and Israel still applies it and uses it to keep dozens of journalists behind bars. They are right now, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, they have the highest number of detained journalists in the world. That's, I believe, within Israel or its occupied territories. If we consider the devastation that has been done, I'll conclude with this, that the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate have a jarring accounting of the destruction that has been carried out against all media institutions in the Gaza Strip. So according to them, since October 7th, and this is from a couple of weeks ago, it could be worse now, airstrikes have demolished 73 media facilities, including 21 local radio stations, 15 local and international news agencies, 15 TV stations, 6 local newspapers, 3 broadcasting towers, 8 printing presses, and 13 journalistic service institutions. And then they also point out that Al-Shawa and Al-Hasiri towers in Gaza City, which contain 15 floors of media offices, were completely destroyed by an Israeli airstrike on December 18th, 2023, causing extensive damage to that surrounding area. But they're quick to point out, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, that this isn't unique to the war after October 7th. And in fact, this has been a policy of the Israeli government to target and kill journalists for some time.
Let's turn to the subject of the journalist Jeremy Lefredo. Who is he? What was he doing when he got arrested? Who was he with? And what kind of charges is he facing?
Yeah, Jeremy Lefredo is a freelance reporter and also a contributor to The Gray Zone, a website that has stirred controversy, but is primarily known as a website that is challenging U.S. foreign policy. It strives to unearth the different officials and the security operatives that are furthering the U.S. government's agenda globally. And broadly, I would say, challenging, you know, being opposed to the objectives of the United States. Jeremy Lefredo was in Israel after the Iranian government launched missile strikes in retaliation for the deaths of, I believe they were leaders from within Iran. And he went around and was documenting some of the impact sites of those missiles. Now, one thing I left out of my discussion of the state of press freedom in Israel is that there's an Israeli military censor. There's an Israeli military censor that sets out topics and says what media organizations can and can't talk about. And if they're going to talk about those certain topics, then they got to run it by the military censor to be cleared, or else they'll be vulnerable to penalties. There's broadcasting licenses. I suppose those can be revoked within Israel. So there's a military censor. And also broadly, international journalists, including from CNN and others, they play along with this military censor. They allow them to see their work before they go and publish. So he went to these sites. But the problem for the Israeli government is that PBS had a correspondent that went to an impact site outside of the Mossad headquarters, just like Jeremy. And then there were a couple other journalists. I think there's one from ABC. They were all doing the similar reporting, which was to show the coordinates, to describe in specific detail what Iran was successful in striking when they launched attacks on military bases and the spy agency headquarters for Mossad. Importantly, they did not want attention to be brought to the fact that Iran had done some damage to the Israeli military, had inflicted in their attacks some damage. And also, I think it exposed the lie that was being told about how Iran had targeted civilians, because if you went to these impact sites, all of these were what could be considered military or security targets. They were not like Israel. They were not bombing residential apartment complexes and wiping out entire families of Israelis. That's what the Israeli government does to Palestinians, but that was not what Iran was doing. And so they retaliated against Jeremy Lofredo. There's a longer story, I won't get into it, but he was actually detained with four other journalists. There's one particular journalist, Andre X is the name that they go by, that shared an accounting of being stopped by the Israeli army, blindfolded, rounded up, taken off to a military base. Ultimately, the four other journalists were not charged with any offenses, but Lofredo was accused in court of aiding the enemy during wartime and providing information to the enemy. So immediately this detention, which lasted for longer than 36 hours, became much more severe, made international news. He was only released on bail because it was found out. One of the Israeli news sites there, it goes by the name of Ynet News, had actually published an article that went past the Israeli military censor, which contained a copy of a video report that Lofredo had published with this information that the Israeli government claimed was aiding the enemy. And so if he was going to be charged, then this journalist who published this report on Jeremy Lofredo's case would have to be charged, would have to be said to have committed a violation. Since it was cleared, the judge was looking at a very big dilemma here as to how this could be allowed to go forward, and ordered him to be released on bail. At this point, there are no charges, there's no real case pending against him, but he's not allowed to leave Israel until October 20th, so a few days from where we're recording this on October 17th. He had his passport taken from him, and he still does not have his phone. His phone was seized. He did not give them the password, but we can presume that the Mossad or whatever spy services they have, where they cracked into it. So whoever he talked to during his reporting, that's Palestinian or an Arab, should probably be afraid right now, because Israel is likely going after them to intimidate and harass them for speaking to an American journalist.
Well, Kevin, how is the United States responding to the fact that Israel arrested a journalist who's a U.S. citizen?
The response of the U.S. government has been to at least quietly send consular representatives to meet with Jeremy Lofredo. There were people who were diplomats that attended the court proceedings. There were two straight days of court proceedings. But beyond that, publicly, there hasn't been any sort of statement against the Israeli government for this detention. And we could surmise that this has something to do with the identity of the gray zone. I don't want to get into this and go into it for a long time, but just to briefly, one thing I made sure I included when I reported on Jeremy Lofredo's arrest was to go back to a few months ago when there was a Washington Post reporter who tried to pin a smear on the gray zone and say that they were receiving funds from Iranian state media. And this was being promoted by people within Israel's establishment, political establishment, people linked to the Israeli military, security agencies, and also similar groups of people, groups of individuals within the United States, media people as well that were aligned with these types of folks. And then when that was proven to be false, Washington Post had to retract this claim about this organization, which they were clearly trying to damage their reputation. But here we're seeing with Jeremy Lofredo that this is having an impact where I wouldn't be surprised to learn that the Israeli military thought they were detaining a propagandist for Iran when they had him and brought him into the courtroom. That was what they were, that's why they were so confident they could accuse him of aiding the enemy during wartime. So that's why they felt they could treat him differently than a PBS NewsHour correspondent, because they think that he might have some links based on this false reporting that has been shared widely about the gray zone. But the U.S. hasn't really done anything to speak up for him, primarily because he's linked to this outlet that is so opposed, so vehemently opposed to U.S. foreign policy.
Kevin, on the international stage, who are the voices standing up for press freedom and calling out Israel for targeting journalists? And who's remaining silent?
On the international stage, we see organizations that do have global reach, like the Reporters Without Borders or Committee to Protect Journalists. There's the International Federation of Journalists, which is, you know, a kind of umbrella organization with a lot of different journalist unions. Membership. They actually provide solidarity to the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, which I mentioned earlier. They built a center, a solidarity center in one of the areas in Gaza. There's a second one that they've tried to construct to give Gaza journalists kind of place to come and do their work. Obviously, they're not going to be able to entirely protect them from being bombed by the Israeli military, but it allows them a place to get some support, have internet connectivity, which has been hit tremendously by this destruction. And then I should say, like, occasionally we've seen groups reach several members in the U.S. Congress, maybe one or two senators. By and large, the U.S. Congress, whether it's in the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate, has not been that engaged. Who's remaining silent? Well, there's your answer. The U.S. Congress, the State Department and its spokesperson, Matthew Miller, is usually fairly dismissive or ignorant when it comes to the risks that journalists are going through, doesn't want to address them because to meaningfully take them seriously would point to the fact that the U.S. has to change its policy, and they're not ready to use any pressure on Israel to actually force them to stop this. You know, they've mostly been tolerant of the ban on Al Jazeera. There's not been anything changed. The only time they really intervened was when Israel, they went a step too far and they decided to confiscate media equipment that was in the possession of the Associated Press and tell them they could no longer shoot video of smoke coming out of the Gaza Strip or show the aftermath of bombings in the Gaza Strip because they were passing that footage on to be used by Al Jazeera, or they were sharing it. It was part of a like collective, or there was some collaboration with AP and Al Jazeera English, and they wanted to shut that down. So there's a lot of silence. There's a lot of people who are not speaking up and should. And one of the things that's been most jarring is you see examples like, I'll end with this example. Several days ago, we had a reporter who was 19 years old, a Palestinian in Gaza. His name was Hassan Hamad. And he was targeted in his room by the Israeli military, according to a colleague. And Barry Malone, the deputy editor-in-chief for Reuters, he sent and posted, I found this to be pretty poignant what he had to say. Just saw the remains of Palestinian journalist Hassan Ahmad reduced to a plastic bag and a shoebox. According to a fresh tally from the Committee to Protect Journalists, 123 journalists have now been killed in Israeli strikes. If you're a journalist and you're not speaking out in solidarity, why? That was just before October 7th anniversary, and I think it really begs the question. There's been so many in the U.S. news media here who haven't raised alarm about what's going on, and yet so many colleagues globally, you know, are being impacted. And we know that there wouldn't be this kind of silence around attacks on Ukrainian journalists. And here we can see, I think, a kind of prejudice towards showing solidarity for these people who are being exterminated.
So if the international community, including the U.S., allows Israel to target, intimidate, or even kill journalists with impunity, what dangers does this pose for our future?
What this means is that we're letting a group basically be denied the right to exercise their freedom of expression. As we know, anytime that you let one group be deprived of rights, it has the potential to spread to a second group, a third group. And then before it might reach your group. Let's say you don't care about the journalists in Gaza, but eventually it might be that journalists you do care about are being targeted, are being detained, are being tortured, are being executed and not allowed to do their work, basically paying quite a heavy price for trying to do their jobs. So this is why, although it sounds a little bit cliche coming out of the mouth of President Joe Biden, this is why the slogan or the phrase of journalism is not a crime is so important. And I also think, you know, there are some linked to the United Nations who have said things like, journalists are not a target. That's an important thing to state clearly, too. Now, I don't think there's any way that you can avoid the outcome of so many journalists being killed when you're seeing so much death among the civilian population. There's estimates from medical doctors that figure could be somewhere around 110,000 to 120,000. And truly, although we've only officially counted about 42,000 deaths at this point, but when you have so much death, it's going to be impossible for journalists to be wholly excluded. That said, we've seen evidence that at least half of these deaths, it would seem, nearly half of these deaths are showing signs that Israeli snipers targeted those journalists, or you know, that other military operations, you know, were carried out with the goal of killing those journalists, of making those media institutions no longer able to function.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. We're speaking with Kevin Gastola, who's the editor of the Center newsletter. Kevin, where can listeners learn more about you and about your work?
Oh, yeah, you can go to thedissenter.org. That's thedissenter.org. It's a newsletter that's focused on not just press freedom, but also will cover whistleblower stories and as well as government secrecy. And this case of Jeremy Lofredo is one that means a lot to me, and while I will follow it closely because I've followed Espionage Act prosecutions, and that's their arena where we've heard talk about aiding the enemy, and no doubt, you know, they're saying what Jeremy did was aiding the enemy.
Yeah, Kevin Gastola, you were one of the reporters that covered the Julian Assange case, even wrote a book about it. You did brilliant work there. I wanted to ask you, now that Julian is free, can you give us, in a nutshell, your balance sheet on the whole situation?
Tying the case of Julian Assange to our conversation that we've just had about Gaza and press freedom for journalists, I mean, look, we see that Israel has criminalized Jeremy Lofredo, and they said aiding the enemy during wartime. Well, there was a component of Julian Assange's prosecution under the Espionage Act that basically had accusations of Julian Assange aiding the enemy when he published documents about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. These were documents that came from Chelsea Manning. So now Julian Assange is free, and he's left his prison cell. He's been recuperating with his family. And we saw extraordinarily over the last couple of weeks him come forward before the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe to speak for the first time since he was expelled from Ecuador's London embassy and faced an indictment. It was just really incredible to hear him and know that he's still able to address everyone and deal with these issues very clearly. The Council of Europe committee actually declared him a political prisoner during his time in detention in the United Kingdom. But what really is striking to me, and this ties into our conversation quite well, that a collateral murder, as in the video that is known so well from WikiLeaks, showing an Apache helicopter attack in Iraq in Baghdad, that you know he left his cell to log on to the internet, and he's basically seeing a kind of live-streamed massacre every day, a collateral murder every day. And he's wondering, how have we become so desensitized to this? When collateral murder was shared with the public in 2010, everyone was stunned. There was a lot of discussion about it. It's one of the most enduring disclosures from WikiLeaks, one of their biggest and most major publications. But now, every other day, there's something horrific like that. And you do wonder how much we've lost of ourselves because collectively, our humanity, we haven't been able to stop this carnage. And I could feel it in Assange's voice that as he's dealing with the future of WikiLeaks, what he's going to do, one of the things he's grappling with is that there is so much war happening, so much death being shared, and nobody's intervening to stop it.
Kevin Gastola, Maria and I are very grateful for your good work and your being on Law and Disorder Radio. Can you repeat one more time how people can get in touch with you and your work?
Yes, if you'd like to support my work, you can go to thedissenter.org, thedissenter.org. It's a free subscription newsletter, and you can follow my stories on whistleblowers, press freedom, and government secrecy there.
Great. Thank you, Kevin.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
One issue from the Cold War still looms large today, the growing threat of nuclear war. While many hoped the end of the Cold War would signal a retreat from the nuclear arms race, recent developments suggest otherwise. Tensions among the U.S., Russia, and China have escalated, and key nuclear arms control treaties, such as the INF Treaty, have eroded, with the future of the new START agreement uncertain. The war in Ukraine, punctuated by Russia's nuclear saber-rattling, has revived fears of potential nuclear escalation. And at the same time, huge sums are funneled into expanding and modernizing nuclear arsenals. Within the past decades, it's estimated that the total cost of modernizing and maintaining the U.S. nuclear arsenal amounts to roughly $1.7 trillion. Emerging technologies, such as hypersonic missiles and artificial intelligence in military decision-making, further complicate the stability of nuclear deterrence, raising new questions about global security. Today, we're joined by Dr. Ira Helfand, a member of the International Steering Group of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. They're the recipient of the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. Helfand is past president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, or IPPNW. They're a founding partner of ICAN, and they received the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. Helfand co-founded and was past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, the U.S. affiliate of IPPNW. He is also co-founder of the Back from the Brink campaign, the key vehicle for people in the U.S. who want to get involved in this issue. Welcome, Dr. Helfand, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure being here with you.
If a nuclear war were to occur in the near future, please paint a picture of what the immediate and the long-term effects would be, and don't spare the details.
Yeah, this is a tough topic, but it's one we really need people to understand because as a society, we have forgotten what's going to happen if there's a nuclear war. It's something which we used to know in detail, all of us. The immediate effects of a nuclear conflict would be absolutely devastating in the cities that were attacked. A lot of people have images in their mind of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they're powerful warnings of how destructive nuclear weapons can be, but they don't begin to prepare us for what would happen today, because Hiroshima was one bomb, 15 kilotons. In a war today between the United States and Russia, there'd be many bombs on many cities, each of which anywhere is from 60 to 50 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. The best estimate that we have from a study that was done back in 2002 is that if only 300 of the 1,500 warheads that the Russians have got through to cities here in the United States, something like 100 million people would die in the first afternoon from the explosions, from the fires, from the prompt radiation effects. And a similar number would be killed in Russia. And if NATO were involved in the conflict, most of the cities in Europe and Canada would be destroyed as well. And so we're talking about something like 200 to 300 million people dead in a single afternoon. In addition, all the people who survived that first round of explosions and fires and radiation would be living in a world that is just literally unimaginable to us. None of the things that we require to stay alive would be available. There'd be no public health system. There'd be no internet. There'd be no electric grid. There'd be no cell phones, no system for distributing food or heating oil, no law and order, no banking system. And in the months after that initial attack, most of the people in the countries that fought the war would also die. They'd die from starvation, from exposure to the elements, from epidemic disease, from radiation poisoning. But that's only talking about the people that live in the countries that fight the war. The huge numbers of fires that these atomic explosions caused would put enormous amounts of soot in the upper atmosphere. About 150 million tons is the best estimate that we have. And this would block out the light from the sun, dropping temperatures across the planet at an average of 18 degrees Fahrenheit. In the interior regions of North America and Eurasia, the temperatures would drop anywhere from 45 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And under these conditions, which are colder than anything we've seen on this Earth since the last ice age, all the ecosystems that have evolved since the end of that ice age would collapse. Food production would essentially stop. And according to a study that was published in 2022, 3/4 of the human race, between 5 and 6 billion people, would starve to death in the first 2 years. And the study stopped at 2 years. The famine would not. It would continue. So we don't know what the ultimate death toll would be. That same study, by the way, also showed that a much more limited war, as might take place between India and Pakistan, would kill 100 million people there in South Asia, but it would also cause the same kind of worldwide climate disruption and famine, not quite as severe as in a large-scale war between the United States and Russia, but bad enough to kill 2 billion people in the first 2 years, including 130 million people here in the United States, even though the war took place on the other side of the planet. So this is a very grim picture, and this is very unpleasant stuff to listen to or talk about, but this is the danger we are facing every day that we allow these weapons to continue to exist, and we have to come to terms with that.
You're so right, observing that we don't have this kind of discussion the way we did a few decades ago. Let's talk about the current situation. The Russian-Ukraine war has seen unprecedented nuclear threats from Russia. including statements from Putin about using nuclear weapons if Russia feels existentially threatened. How serious do you think these threats are?
I think the threats are serious. We don't know exactly what the red line would be that would cause Putin to use his nuclear arsenal, and that's part of the problem. But the fact that these threats have been made so frequently and so explicitly, which is totally unprecedented throughout the nuclear weapons era, I think requires that we take them very seriously. There is a real possibility that the war in Ukraine could escalate to a nuclear conflict, even if it wasn't the deliberate plan of Russia to use its nuclear weapons. When tensions are this high, it's so easy for something to be misinterpreted, for a faulty radar signal to be interpreted as an attack by the other side. This has happened many times in the past, never at times of this high level of crisis. So this is a very dangerous situation, and it's not the only one. There are others, other geopolitical circumstances which could also lead to nuclear war.
Let's talk about that in a minute. I wanted to ask you how climate change and resource scarcity play, if any, a role in increasing the potential for future conflicts, including nuclear ones. Could environmental crises, for example, push nations armed with nuclear weapons closer to the brink?
That's a great question, Heidi, and the climate crisis absolutely could act as a threat multiplier in that way. We don't often think of nuclear war and the climate crisis together in this way, but we need to. You know, all 9 of the countries which have nuclear weapons claim that they intend to get rid of them someday when the world is safer. But the world isn't getting safer, and it's the climate crisis that's making it more dangerous. Over the coming decades, as the climate crisis continues to unfold, which it will, even if we do all the things we're supposed to try to mitigate the situation, as the climate crisis unfolds, significant portions of the planet are simply not going to be able to support their human population. And this is going to cause incredible conflict within societies as people fight over scarce resources, between nations, again, fighting over scarce resources. It's going to trigger migration on a scale we have never seen in human history, far worse than the migration that we're seeing today, which has caused so much political disruption. And if nuclear weapons are still on the table as all of this conflict and turmoil unfolds, the chance that they're used is going to continue to grow.
We've seen significant arms control agreements collapse in recent years. The Trump administration withdrew from the INF Treaty in 2018. Can you explain to listeners what that treaty was and the impact it may have on the global nuclear threat? And also, if you don't mind, discuss the New START Treaty, which is set to expire, I believe, in 2026, and how important these agreements are for global security.
I think all of these agreements are very important for global security, although they're not they're necessary, but they're not sufficient. As we've seen, they can be abrogated, and a number of these agreements, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the INF Treaty, that's the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, have been abridged, and the New START agreement is set to expire in, I think it's February of 2026. These were attempts to put guardrails on the nuclear arms race, to create some sense of rules that people that had nuclear weapons would follow. And the fact that these agreements have collapsed basically leaves us in a very dangerous situation without any guardrails at all. But I think the primary thing we need to understand is that even when these were in place, the danger didn't go away, and they were all susceptible to being abandoned, as they have been. What we really need is an agreement amongst all of the nuclear armed states to eliminate their arsenals completely. And they need to sit down and negotiate an agreement which specifies a timetable for eliminating their weapons, a verification mechanism so that everyone involved will know that the other side is doing what it's supposed to do, and enforcement mechanisms to make sure that people do carry out their agreements. This is not going to be easy, but this is necessary. If we don't get rid of these weapons, it is not a question of if, it is only a question of when they're used. And as we were just talking about, if these weapons are used, it is going to be a catastrophe unimaginable, unprecedented in human history, and will almost certainly be the end of modern civilization as we know it. So the question can't be, should we try to get rid of nuclear weapons, but simply, how do we proceed? What's the best way to do this? And how do we get the governments of the world to understand the extraordinary danger they are exposing us all to by their current nuclear policies, which are all based on this false idea of deterrence, that somehow nuclear weapons magically inhibit them from themselves from ever being used, and therefore nuclear weapons make us safe. We need to understand instead that nuclear weapons are the greatest threat to our safety, to our security, and indeed to our survival. And the only way we can guarantee that we're going to be safe is to get rid of them.
You know, I grew up watching movies like On the Beach, Hunt for Red October, I think it was Failsafe, in the sort of shadow of the Cold War. We lived with the specter of nuclear war. Why do you think it's changed in the last few decades? The public seems a little numb or even unaware of this threat.
The threat was enormously well perceived during the 80s in particular. People lived in real dread that there would be a nuclear war. And I think when the Cold War ended, when the Soviet Union disbanded, when the Warsaw Pact disbanded, there was just this palpable sense of relief. You could feel it everywhere, that we had somehow dodged the bullet and we weren't going to have to worry about nuclear war anymore. And we very deliberately put this whole topic out of mind. And it's understandable why we would do that. It's not pleasant to think about nuclear war, but it was a kind of denial that was not functional. This wasn't something that helped us to survive because the threat didn't go away, even though we stopped paying attention to it. And there's been a real resistance ever since then to readdressing this threat, I think largely because people just don't want to have to worry about this anymore. There's a lot of other things in the world to worry about today, especially the climate crisis. But this is the reality that we are living with. These weapons are still here. The danger of their being used is greater than it's ever been, and it's growing. And so we can't afford the luxury of ignoring this anymore. We have to address it. And it's starting to change. I think, you know, we've noticed over the last year a number of things that have focused increased attention on the nuclear danger. The New York Times is running this terrific series of articles called At the Brink, in which the Times advocates for the abolition of nuclear weapons, something which it never took seriously before. The same week that that series began to run in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times had an op-ed by Ernest Moniz, the former Secretary of Energy, the government department which makes the nuclear weapons, in which he advocated the elimination of all of these weapons. Annie Jacobson has published a wonderful book, Nuclear War, a Scenario, that helps people understand the immediacy of this danger. And this book has gotten a significant amount of attention. It's a New York Times bestseller. It's been widely reviewed, and there have been many articles written about it. And I don't think 2 years ago it would have gotten this kind of attention. So there's something changing here. People are starting to pay attention to this. And it's our job, and I'm delighted that you are doing this segment today about nuclear war. We need to encourage all branches of the media to start focusing more on this issue, as they did to such important effect back in the 1980s.
Ira, you mentioned the New York Times series related to The Brink, and that brings us to the question of your work with the organization, the nonprofit Back from the Brink, that you're involved with. Can you talk a bit about its work?
Yeah, I'd be pleased to. Back from the Brink was started in 2017. It took its inspiration from the success of the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons in securing the adoption at the United Nations of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW, work for which ICANN won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. We were acutely aware, those of us who were working on the ICANN campaign here in the United States, that we did not have a significant grassroots movement here in the U.S. And so we decided that we needed to try to build one. And we have organized this campaign around a simple prescription for what U.S. nuclear policy ought to be. Specifically, we call on the United States to enter into the negotiations I alluded to before with the other eight nuclear weapon states for an agreement to eliminate their arsenals. And when we asked the United States to take a number of interim steps as those negotiations proceed to demonstrate good faith and to give momentum to those negotiations. We asked the U.S. to adopt a no-first-use policy, to say we will never start nuclear war. Currently, that's not the U.S. policy. The U.S. reserves the right to use nuclear weapons first, even against countries that don't have nuclear weapons. We asked the United States to end the situation where the president has unchecked authority to launch nuclear war. No one person should ever have that kind of power. And yet that is the situation here in the United States today. There should be some check on the ability to use these terrible weapons. We asked the United States to take its nuclear weapons off hair trigger alert. Hundreds of these weapons are sitting on missiles that can be launched in less than 15 minutes. This is totally unnecessary and exposes these weapons to the danger of cyber attack. And this should change. And finally, we asked the United States to rethink this plan to spend $1.7 trillion over the next three decades modernizing every single aspect of its nuclear arsenal with enhanced weapons. This is helping to fuel a global arms race. It is leading us in the wrong direction. We shouldn't be building a new nuclear arsenal. We should be working to eliminate the nuclear arsenal that we and the other eight nuclear armed states have. So this campaign we've taken this platform of policies and gone to organizations, communities around the country, asking them to support it. And this has happened to an extraordinary degree. There are some 75 cities across the country which have passed resolutions supporting this, including Boston, Baltimore, Washington, Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Des Moines. We've gotten similar resolutions passed in the state legislature in California, in Oregon, in Rhode Island, and in the Maine Senate in the New Jersey Assembly. We have a resolution currently before the Congress, HRES 77, that has 44 co-sponsors, and again calls on the United States to adopt this policy platform. And we have over 480 non-governmental organizations around the country which have endorsed this campaign and joined it, including some of the largest environmental groups like the Sierra Club, the NRDC, 350, many of the large national faith communities, the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Church, the Congregational Church, the Unitarian Church, the Reconstructionist Jewish Movement, the Islamic Society of North America, Pax Christi within the Catholic community. And recently, there's been a new organization started, which we're particularly excited about, called Students for Nuclear Disarmament, which is led by high school and college students and is organizing on campuses around the country to draw attention amongst this younger generation, which has never been educated about nuclear war, draw their attention to this issue as well. And finally, most recently, a number of labor unions have endorsed the campaign, and we're looking forward to reaching out very actively to other labor unions to get their support for this effort to change U.S. nuclear policy.
Excellent news. We really applaud your efforts, Ira, and the work of so many others who are trying to educate the public. I want to go back to that trigger warning that you mentioned. Can you describe that a little more, and under what possible scenario would that be needed?
Well, there is no reason why we should have that today. The idea of keeping weapons on hair trigger alert is a vestige of the Cold War, when it was feared, because we didn't understand what the damage would be, it was feared that an opponent, the Soviet Union, could launch a surprise attack and take out all of our land-based missiles, and then we would be disarmed. But that's not the circumstance in the world today. The United States has a fleet of nuclear missile submarines that are at sea at all times, each one of which has the ability to destroy Russia and to cause enormous global harm and probably enough firepower to trigger a global famine. So even if our land-based missiles were taken out in a surprise attack, we still have the ability to utterly destroy any enemy that we chose to respond in that fashion to. So there's no rationale at all for keeping these land-based missiles on this hair trigger alert. And the danger is that land-based missiles in this configuration can be subject to a cyber attack, and that cyber attack could conceivably cause them to be launched even when it was not the intention of the U.S. government to do so.
Let's talk about cyber attack. There's been much focus recently on new military technologies like hypersonic missiles and artificial intelligence and nuclear command and control systems. How do these advancements affect the stability of nuclear deterrence? And in your opinion, do they increase the risk of accidental nuclear war?
Yeah, I think every technological advance that we have increases the instability because it puts countries more on edge. Hypersonic weapons have a much shorter flight time, and so people feel they have less time to make a decision if they're going to respond. The potential mating of artificial intelligence with nuclear weapon systems, I think, should terrify everyone. We simply don't know enough about artificial intelligence, about its limitations, about its powers, to give command and control over nuclear weapon systems in any way to these kind of advanced computer systems and take humans out of the loop in decision-making. And I think there's a very great danger that as artificial intelligence is increasingly used in military applications, that we will be moving in just that direction. We're not there at this time, but it is a real danger that's looming on the horizon.
Can you explain briefly what first strike capacity means, and is the U.S. cultivating this?
I'm not sure that I know what it means, because I don't think it makes any sense, but the idea is that a country would have the ability to launch an attack against its enemy and completely disarm it so that it couldn't strike back. The United States and Russia have both sought to have a first strike capacity, and I think it's a fool's errand. Both countries have the ability to survive a first strike and launch a retaliatory strike that would utterly destroy the country that attacked them. This is part of the doctrine of deterrence. Supposedly no one would ever launch a first strike because they would fear the counterstrike that would be launched against them. The problem is that people don't make rational decisions all the time. And furthermore, there have been numerous instances when one or the other of the two countries believed that the other side had already launched an attack and prepared to launch its own missiles in response to this non-existent threat. And we have come on multiple occasions within minutes of having an inadvertent and accidental, if you will, nuclear war because of this potential problem. So the idea that we can guarantee our security by having more and more destructive power is just flat out wrong. The only way we can guarantee that these weapons are not used is to get rid of them. You know, this is not something that the peace community alone calls for. People like Robert McNamara, former Secretary of Defense, Colin Powell, former Secretary of State, George Shultz, former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State, all of whom were critical architects of our nuclear policy in the past, have all come to the conclusion that these weapons are too dangerous and should be eliminated. And they've been joined by some of the most important people in the U.S. military. General Lee Butler, who was commander of the Strategic Air Command in the early 1990s, in charge of our nuclear forces, believes that they must be eliminated. They are simply too dangerous. And we need to pursue this actively, not as some distant goal that we hope to achieve sometime in the next century.
Yes, and I think in general, this topic, as you've alluded to, is such an abstraction with most people. We don't have the luxury of time in changing that. In our last few minutes, I wanted to ask you, do we have measures in place to prevent cyber attacks targeting nuclear arsenals?
We do. We have a very robust cyber defense initiative here in the United States that dates back to the movie War Games in 1983, which showed a teenager hacking into NORAD, the North American Radar Defense System, and triggering a false alarm. So there's been a real effort to try to guard against cyber attack. The problem is that despite these efforts, U.S. military computers are hacked into repeatedly every day. It's just much harder to defend against a cyber attack because you never know what form it's going to take. And so despite our best efforts, it is possible that at some point someone will succeed in hacking into the command and control systems of the U.S. nuclear forces. And they could either directly launch our weapons or perhaps more likely trigger another false alert and trick the United States into launching our weapons. You know, this is just one of the many ways in which a nuclear war could start.
It's funny. I read that Ronald Reagan, when he was president, had a private screening at Camp David of the film War Games. And after that, I sort of looked around the room and asked everyone, do you think this is possible?
As I've heard, it was that when he asked the question, he was initially assured, oh, no, this is just, right. Don't worry about this, Mr. President.
Right.
But then he said, well, look into it for me.
Yeah.
And his people came back the next week and said, Mr. President, we have a problem.
Right.
This could happen.
Right. That's
right.
That
was the beginning of U.S. cybersecurity initiatives.
Yes. Yeah. Ira, do you have anything to add that we haven't covered on this literal matter of life and death topic?
Yeah, the thing I would want to say is that no one of us is going to solve this problem alone, but every one of us has a responsibility to do what we can to solve this problem, to figure out what contribution we can make. The Back from the Brink campaign, I think, is the best vehicle we've had in the United States in decades to deal with a nuclear threat, and I would encourage people to become involved with it. Our website is easy to remember. It's preventnuclearwar.org. And I would encourage people to visit the website and learn how they can become involved. If we all do our part, we can change U.S. nuclear policy. We've done this in the past. In the 1980s, a very large civil society movement, the Freeze Campaign, brought about profound change in U.S. nuclear policy. And I think we can do the same thing again today. But we all have to do our part in this. And we need not to feel overwhelmed by the enormity of the problem, but rather challenged by it. You know, every one of us wants our life to be important. We want to do something good with our life. Those of us living today literally have the chance to save the world. And that's about the best thing anyone can ever do. And I hope people will hear this message, as depressing as it is in some ways, in that spirit, as a challenge to the greatest adventure in human history, the struggle to save our planet.
Ira, thank you for your really invaluable insight into the gravity of the nuclear threat and what we as a global community must do to prevent a catastrophe to our humanity. We'd really love to stay in touch with you and Back from the Brink and get updates on this issue because, as you say, everyone has to pitch in to reverse course. So thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with me today and giving me the chance to share this information, and look forward to staying in touch with you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.